First case on our calendar, 05293, the Glidden Company versus Lumbermen's Mutual Casualty Company. Mr. Bowman.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, William Bowman on behalf of Appellant Hartford. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time there.
This insurance coverage case presents not the usual issue of what is covered under an insurance policy, but rather the more preliminary and fundamental issue of who is insured under that policy. The Court of Appeals majority ruled that Glidden III was an insured under these policies under the so-called operation of law theory, even though there's no dispute that, one, Glidden III was a stranger to the contracts and never paid a premium. Two, the asset purchase agreement here explicitly excluded the insurance. Three, Glidden III voluntarily assumed these liabilities as part of that asset purchase. And four, there's an actual successor to SCM, Millennium Holdings, that everyone agrees is insured under these policies. Glidden III's theory is not that there's been a transfer from Company 1 to Company 2. Rather, there's been some insurance mitosis under which both Company 1 and Company 2 are insured. I'd like to step back and try to put this case in a context, if I could. The first, a contract context, and the second, a liability insurance context. The contract context is that this case involves purely contractual relationships voluntarily entered by the parties. This means that we shouldn't confuse underlying tort liability with contract rights and obligations. For example, parties have a right not to be forced into a contract relationship with a stranger, and courts are not permitted to rewrite insurance policies. The second context point relates to liability policies. Liability insurance policies provide coverage only for the insured, or, in the words of the policy, what the insured becomes legally obligated to pay as damages. They don't, for example, provide coverage for an explosion generally, but rather for the insured's liability for that explosion and not other parties' liability.
Counsel, is the dispute here about the tail on a policy?
Well, in part it is, because you have a situation with these occurrence policies where claims can be made after the policies have expired as long as the injury occurred during the policy period. And we accept that. What we're saying is we are prepared to and are providing coverage for our insured Millennium and SCM, but what we don't accept is the idea that we should also be forced to provide coverage for a party that is not our insured under the policies, and that's Glidden. So yes, in part, that part of this arises because not every claim comes up during the policy period. But that also responds to one of the points that is made by our opponent here, and that is that somehow this insurance would be lost or would vanish or something like that. That is not the case because, of course, Millennium and SCM remain defendants in these very same claims. They seek the very same coverage. This coverage is subject to limits, and so the insurance doesn't vanish. It remains for the party that is the insured under our policies and is not available for parties who are not insured under our policies.
Counsel, under what situation can you envision that a carrier would grant assignment? Because when I looked at the situations in the tails, I can't find any scenario that would lend itself to wanting to grant an assignment. You cut off, if we rule in your favor, you cut off your liability once that successor takes ownership of the corporation, and I can't imagine why you would want to give an assignment.
Well, let me answer that question by pointing out first that this case does not necessarily get to the assignment issue. In other words, we say there was no assignment, there was an explicit reservation of the policies. If you got to the assignment issue, then the question would be, is this an assignment or is this something different than an assignment? We say it would be an assignment squared. In other words, you're not simply assigning the rights from one company to another, you're doubling it. Company one and company two both have it. The record is pretty bare here with respect to what would happen if you got to that assignment issue. I know the court will look more carefully at that in the next case, Pilkington, because it's one of the certified questions.
But isn't one of the bases of your defense is that you have an anti-assignment clause, and that anti-assignment clause, because you did not give permission, prevents the tail from following the successors?
It is one of our defenses, but it is fourth or fifth in the line.
Okay, then let me go back to my question, which you didn't answer, is why would you ever want to grant an assignment?
Because it would be a matter, again, the record's bare. There's no evidence that an assignment was ever requested in this case, but it would be a matter of negotiation. If, in fact, there were no, the other company were completely defunct and not being sued anymore, perhaps the insurer would grant an assignment. Perhaps the insurer would negotiate with the proposed new insured under the circumstances under which it might agree to this.
For a fair sum, perhaps, but your anti-assignment clause essentially allows you to really control and limit your exposure, which is fine, but I just can't envision a scenario in which you would give, without additional cost or additional premiums paid, an assignment to anybody because of the exposure that you would have that would be cut off by the sale.
It could well be a matter of an additional premium payment because, of course, we would be adding an insurer that was not an insured under the policy previously.
How does that change your exposure?
Adding the additional insured?
Yeah.
It would change it in several ways. Under the Court of Appeals rationale, we now have an insured SCM Millennium. We would be adding, under their rationale, Glidden. There were 10 or 20 so-called fan companies as a result of this Hansen acquisition. We could be called upon to defend or indemnify those 10 or 20 companies as you go down over the years.
But your exposure is for occurrences that cause harm, is it not?
Yes, our exposure is for our insurance.
That doesn't change regardless of who's holding the tail, does it?
Yes, it does, because
how?
It changes because of the insureds. In other words, we would have to defend, instead of one insured, two insureds, or after a series of asset transfers, maybe dozens of insureds. That would greatly increase the defense costs that we would be facing. In other
because you have to deal with more than one general counsel, or
no,
or what?
Because we would have to provide perhaps a separate defense at each insured's insistence. We would have to deal with the situation where insureds
you're still
are
dealing with the same underlying facts, are you not?
We are dealing with the same potential underlying liability, but for example, insureds could say, we want you to bring a cross claim against this other defendant who's your insured, or we want you to defend this cross claim. Or you now have 20 or 30 insureds instead of one. And so you not only increase the defense obligation under modern tort system, as we all know, most cases get settled. And when they're settled, every defendant is a pocket that must pay. So we contend that we would increase both defense and indemnity.
Say Glidden just went away. What's your obligation then to injured parties?
If Glidden went away, or if the original insured went away?
Well, the original insured, yes.
If the original insured simply went away,
gave the company back to the shareholders.
The fact of the matter is that does not end the insurer's obligations. There are example after example of companies that exist only as a shell and exist only as a defendant in the tort system. So as long as there is insurance available, those companies tend to exist. Even when those companies file, for example, for bankruptcy, our policies say pretty clearly that does not end our obligations, therefore we continue to pay. And therefore, that gets back to the point the insurance doesn't vanish, there's no windfall. If there's a windfall, it's to Glidden.
And so I'm having a hard time understanding how does that differ then from a new company assuming the assets and liabilities of the previous company in terms of the responsibility of your company for the people injured that are covered by the liability tail.
I guess what I'm saying is it's quite unlikely that the first company simply disappears. The first company will continue to be sued as long as there's insurance available. That we have responsibilities there. The second company is sued, just as here, where we have two defendants that we're separately defending. And that's an increase in burden. That's what we haven't agreed to. A very important part of liability insurance is that we've agreed to defend this particular insured, not a whole group of insureds, whether it's for the same liabilities or different liabilities. That's the increased burden, defense costs, indemnity costs. I'd also point out that in this particular case, Glidden is being sued not just for conduct that occurred pre-1986, in other words, the selling the lead paint, but also for post-1986 conduct, such as sending out instructions about how to scrape and sand paint, not taking into account that the paint on the walls may already be lead paint. And therefore, we have that. Let me turn for a moment, if I could, to this operation of law theory. This is a theory that has been not accepted by Ohio and New York courts, and that's the law we say applies here. In Ohio, we say long ago in Gilbert, this court rejected the notion and said that an insurance contract does not pass by operation of law to the purchaser of a property. That case also involved a post-loss purchase. New York law similarly has rejected the theory in EM Industries. Other courts around the country have rejected it. The California appellate courts and the California Supreme Court and Henkel have rejected it. The Wisconsin appellate court and Red Arrow rejected it. Most recently, last month, the Sixth Circuit rejected it in Arrow Motive, affirming the Michigan District Court. And the few courts around the country that have accepted this operation of law theory have accepted it only when there's a clear law that imposes the liability, not where it's voluntarily assumed as here. A clear law such as in California, where there's a product line successor liability that imposes the liability on the successor, or environmental statute CERCLA that imposes the liability. Here there's no dispute that neither Ohio nor New York accepts the product line successor liability theory. There's no CERCLA statute at work. What we have is a purely voluntary assumption.
And Counsel, let's talk about the real economic world for a moment, because the insurance overlay is that. And if there were not economic activity, there's no reason for insurance. If the liability coverage that existed for this tail is not transferable, then companies that are in a business that suddenly have a bad surprise with respect to liability issues, they're just frozen in time, are they not, in terms of selling businesses or transferring assets or those kind of, they just have to grind away until it's all gone.
Not at all, Your Honor. There are many, many options that are used every day by companies. There are statutory mergers. There are stock purchases. Companies buy assets without assuming liabilities. Companies buy assets and get indemnified against pre-sale liabilities, as Glidden did here, as Glidden's predecessor did here. There are many, many ways that companies can and do protect themselves.
Counsel, was there an actual discussion of these insurance policies at the time that the company changed form? It seemed to me that the argument you made early was that these insurance policies expressly were not transferred.
That's correct. In the deal between SCM and Glidden's predecessor.
So there was a discussion of this whole issue, and the choice was in negotiations not to have the transfer occur.
That's exactly right. Okay. These insurance policies were expressly excluded from
the counsel,
transfer.
But, counsel, isn't there a difference, in theory at least, between ownership of the policy and a right to the benefits of coverage for post-transfer occurrences?
Yes, there is a potential distinction that could be drawn there, but ultimately it does not make any difference because they're saying that even if you're talking about part of the policy or right to coverage for particular types of claims, Glidden is saying we've got the right to coverage even though we agree that the original insured also has the right to coverage, therefore we're doubling or more your responsibilities under your policies and adding an insured you've never agreed to.
Okay, and is there authority that precludes the Glidden, for example, and the other company from having the rights exercised and the ownership not be with Glidden?
Well, if there were an assignment to which insurers consented, yes. What we're saying in the primary point of our argument here is that this operation of law theory should not be accepted, that this court should not be the first Supreme Court to accept this operation of law theory. There are other ways to assign insurance.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Bowman. Mr. Passanante.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I'm here with my co-counsel, Drew Carson, and my colleague, Court Malone, on behalf of the Glidden Company, a Cleveland-based paint company. And the central issue here is what happened between 1967 and 1986. Those are the tail years, Your Honors. And those operations of the paints business, which paints business subsequently became Glidden, is what's at issue. Our opponents will characterize the rule we seek and the rule applied by the Court of Appeals below as though this is a tort concept. Frankly, this rule is completely, the operation of law rule is completely consistent with predictability and certainty in contract. It's completely consistent with existing contract and insurance law.
Were they excluded by the contract?
The policies were an excluded asset under the contract. However, I'll have to explain a little bit because both courts below disagreed with our position on this, and we respectfully disagree with that finding. However, there was an amendment to that contract, which is in the record, which explicitly reserved the rights of the policies, which were present in the paints business, to the paints business when it was sold. And what does that say? That, and it's referred to as the side letter agreement in our papers. That agreement says, regarding this transaction where the paints business was sold from Hansen to ICI, regarding insurance, Hansen shall give ICI and its subsidiaries the benefits of any policy of insurance to the extent the same would provide cover for liability in respect of occurrences relating to the business, that's the paints business, prior to the closing, which is August 14th of 1986, giving rise to loss, injury, or damage thereafter, subject to indemnity on costs.
So would that mean that since both parties have been sued, if the party that owned the policies gets a recovery or gets insurance, it will pass it on to Glidden, the successor? That's how I read that.
It could mean that, Your Honor.
Because the benefits, it doesn't say you get the insurance because you already have a contract that says you don't get the insurance.
Well, Your Honor, except this is part of the same contract, and it's clear that the intent was that the benefits of those policies, including the defense obligation, would apply to both entities. And you might say, well, is that something the parties contemplated when the policies were sold? In our briefs in the Court of Appeals below, we laid out the policy provisions, and I can tell you where those were, the policy provisions that made very clear that when the policies were sold, it was contemplated that multiple entities might make claims. I mean, for example, the named insured provision of the policies all say in form or substance, and this is in page 15 of the brief of the plaintiff dated September 29th, 2003, below. This is what the named insured language says. It includes any subsidiary company, including subsidiaries thereof, of the named insured, which at the time was SCM, and any other company of which SCM assumes active management.
Well, that sort of ignores a third party to a contract. The insurance company is a party to your insurance contract, and they say you can't assign it without our permission, pure basic contract law. So how do you assign it then?
Well,
without their permission and with a contract that says we aren't.
This is a situation, Your Honor, that cries out for a sensible rule, which I...
But is that a sensible rule that a legislature should fashion rather than a court? We've been very strict in Ohio in upholding contract law, and now you want a policy decision that maybe belongs in a different forum.
I think it's an insurance contract principle, and the law at the time these policies were sold was clear that respecting pre-transaction events. So we're not talking about my buying a policy and assigning it to big corporation and saying that my policy, when the underwriter looked at me, now covers big corporation that has a much greater exposure. It's not what we're saying at all. What we're saying is pre-transaction occurrences and events that tail which each of these occurrence policies was sold and underwritten for, they knew they were underwriting the paints business. That's the liability that's at issue. The only liability that's at issue are the years between 1967 and 1986. At 1986, August 14th, 1986, a curtain comes down. That's when the events giving rise to the eventual liability stop. There's no change in the exposure of the insurance company.
Okay, I can agree with you that the actual damage issue stays the same no matter who is involved. But the defense costs can be exponentially increased. How do you address that?
Well, you know, one way to address it is to say that in this case, there was a joint defense of both currently Glidden and SCM until these insurance companies decided to raise this argument. And this argument drove the parties apart. So was there any increased expense? Maybe there was an increased photocopy to send it to two general counsels rather than one. There was no increased expense. And frankly, I don't think there's much increased expense.
But we have to write a rule for many different cases, and you may have the parties start off on opposite ends, and now you're paying two attorneys, you're paying two law firms, you're paying discovery costs. I mean, those are enormous expenses, because I've been in this type of litigation. I used to do business litigation.
That's what was contemplated by the parties, Your Honor. The parties to the insurance policy clearly contemplated that multiple insureds might require a defense. The definition of insured in these policies includes the possibility that another company of which the insured assumes active management, like the paints business, might get sued. These insurance companies were required to defend that paints business. Are defenses sometimes very expensive? Yes. Is it something that was contemplated when this insurance was sold? Absolutely. Still a single plaintiff. That plaintiff has the injuries he or she has. If it requires a multiple defense, I submit that the answer is in the policies, and they actually contemplate that multiple parties be defended.
Counsel, I have a question about a statement that was made by opposing counsel that said the only time courts in this country have imposed the theory of operation of law, or the only time it arises, is when there's a statutory obligation for liability. And absent that, the courts will not impose that. And then, of course, the host of other courts that have completely abandoned it. How would you respond to that?
Well, I don't think the statutory basis is where we need to look. Again, where I would start is with the nature of the occurrence-based policy. And if the liability imposed arises pre-transaction, so it doesn't have to be statutory like a CERCLA liability.
But would you agree that was the basis upon which the courts of other jurisdictions have premised the operation of law? And if Ohio was to adopt it, this would be a deviation from the foundation.
I don't think so, Your Honor, because, and I'll try to respond to your question, but maybe a different way. If you don't adopt a rule, something analogous to the operation of law rule, what happens? These comprehensive general liability policies, which have been sold to industrial companies and other businesses in Ohio for the last 60 years, will all of a sudden, perhaps, not be available because In 1950, there was an asset sale. Or in 1970, there was an asset sale. There is a tremendous chance that if you don't adopt a rule that gives business owners certainty and predictability, which is what the operation of law rule does. The operation of law rule says that with regard to these special contracts, their occurrence-based liability policies, here's how we're going to apply the obligation of the insurance company to defend and indemnify. And that is, with regard to historic claims, that the liability insurance will follow the liability, such that if a corporation is sued today, say it's today's Glidden Company, if we had been, by merger, the merger successor of the original Glidden Paint Company, I imagine we wouldn't be hearing the same arguments. However, we're not that sort of successor. We're the successor by acquisition of assets.
But I always thought that the basis for predictability and reliability in our system was based on contract without government interference, without the government stepping in and changing the contract made between the parties. What do we do with that principle if we adopt your theory?
Your Honor, I don't think there's any change in the contract at all. The business that was insured here was a division of a company, which the policies say, we cover the incurred but not reported losses. Those are the losses that happened during this time frame.
They're covering it, but there's 10 or more fan companies now. And so now we're covering 10 times the number of companies. We have 10 times the number of clients.
Well, Your Honor, I understand that argument. It's a bit of a red herring because here it's two companies.
Part of the dissenting opinion in the Court of Appeals here.
Well, Your Honor, there were, in fact, the facts of the case. I'm sorry for speaking over you, Your Honor.
Excuse me. There were, in fact,
a number of companies. The companies that actually got significant operations were two. So, yes, was there a complicated corporate divestiture? Yes, and that's exactly the problem. Here we have a situation where the record is clear. The parties intended, through the side letter agreement, whether they did it or not, the courts below disagree with us, they intended that the insurance rights pass. The policies themselves say that we cover you for occurrences during the policy period and include divisions of SCM as an insured. Now, how is it?
Let me pose a different question then based on that side letter. You still have the original company in the lawsuit, correct?
The original company, well, the...
The one that owned the policies has been sued.
Correct.
And if the plaintiffs recover against them, the insurance company will pay the original company, correct? I mean, they're the ones that owned the company when the damage occurred.
There was a litigation for 15 years regarding that and settlements prior, but yes.
Okay, so if the original company's found liable because they were the ones that produced the product that caused the damage, the judgment's against the original company, whether it's against subsequent companies as well, let's put that aside, against the original company. Insurance company has an obligation with the tail policy to pay that, even though the policy may have expired, correct?
These policies don't expire, the policy periods end.
Okay.
Which is central to the argument here, Your Honor.
They have to pay the tail. They pay the first company. And then under your side agreement, that first company has the duty to pass those damage recovery from the insurance company down to the successor because they made a side agreement that if we got any benefits, we have to pass them on to you.
Your Honor, I would suggest that, and I understand your point, Your Honor, I would suggest that this agreement actually makes the benefits of the insurance available directly.
Okay.
Did you complete your answer to Justice O'Donnell's question? I was interested in it. If you maybe you may have forgotten it.
Your Honor, I've lost the thread.
Okay.
There's a couple other. Did I answer your question, Justice?
If you want to expand on it, it's all right. My concern was there's a number of fan companies that are involved here, 10 at least.
Well, Your Honor, on one level, let's say there had been 20 companies that were given significant operations. One company gets the paints business, another company gets the XYZ business and the 123 business. Those businesses have exposures that went with them. And I would submit that the policies actually say those companies are insured under the policy. And at the time of the alternative is to say corporate lawyers, you can't have complicated transactions without the frankly unavailable assent of your insurance company. Why would an insurance company assent to an assignment? They won't. how is it that those productive assets, particularly in industrial companies where there is a tail exposure, get moved from one productive use to another? The operation of law rule permits the more easy movement of productive assets from a company with a historic exposure to some new owner that will insist, I'd like the benefit of your historic insurance because I can't buy insurance today.
But you seems to me you're making two arguments. One is that the insurance contract provides the result for which you argue, but then you, as the Court of Appeals did, had to use this operation of law principle to get to the result, which...
Well, I think the operation of law rule, which I believe the dissent below characterizes as a public policy argument, I think is really simply a creature of contract. And it's inherent in the nature of liability insurance and the general rule in Ohio and elsewhere that these policies can be assigned after the date of loss. Your Honor, there's a couple other quick points. With regard to collateral estoppel, both courts below on the collateral estoppel point, we respectfully submit, got it wrong. Can I finish this point, Your Honor?
Sure.
Frankly, with regard to collateral estoppel, the prior Ohio action that's referred to in our papers, which decided the duty to defend, decided this issue. It decided that Glidden had rights to the policy. And simply because there was a settlement of that case after that ruling, the insurance companies have taken the chance to relitigate that, and we submit that that should be collaterally stopped. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Passanati. Mr. Bowman, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, with respect to the side letter, that was an alternative theory to operation of law, but we say that both courts below correctly concluded that the indirect parent Hansen never had the authority to deal away SCM's rights under the SCM policies. With respect to the fan companies, that's simply an example of what could happen here with asset transfer following asset transfer over the years. You may not end up with 10 companies claiming to be an insured. You may end up with 20 or 30 or 50. Finally, we believe that certainty and predictability is best served by not permitting courts to amend and rewrite contracts. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You will be advised of our opinion.